Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
And Rick, we have some new rules for today's podcast.
New rules.
We've got some new rules. I'm just going to sketch these things out. And these are important rules.
Yeah.
If you don't like the rules, that's tough. If you violate the rules, I'm taking away your podcast hard pass.
That is pretty rough. Well, can I have a follow-up question, John?
No, hey, say, wait a minute. You may ask. You may ask for a So, Rick, new rules. I'm going to get into these rules. I'm going to tell you what the rules are. I'm going to explain there will be a procedure. Once I rule that you have violated a rule, you can ask me to you can ask for an appeal, and I will tell you that why I have denied your appeal.
That sounds like a fair trade. So, John, are before we get into the rules, are you going to follow them? What do you know?
We'll get into that in a second. But first of all, we have a lot to talk about on this special pre-Thanksgiving issue of the Powerhouse Politics podcast. Believe it or not, there are still votes being counted in this country. We will know the extent of the blue wave or lack of a blue wave, or however you want to characterize it. I'll let you do the characterization. You are the political director, as you remind us all the time, Rick.
Indeed.
But we've got Mary Bruce is going to join us and give us the latest, the very latest on the battle to become the Speaker of the House. And Nancy Pelosi, will she or won't she? We have a presidential turkey pardon, or possibly two turkeys, I guess. Is that what happened? We're going to talk about Ivanka's emails. But you asked about the rules. What are you talking about?
Well, I'd like to know, now that there's a certain journalist whose press credentials have been restored.
He
that,
who shall not be named
that fight
on the Powerhouse
has been,
Politics
The fight
podcast.
Has been resolved between a certain network and a certain White House press corps. The White House has put in these new rules that govern presidential press conferences. So, John, walk us through what this means for you. When you're sitting there, you have an opportunity to ask the question, what are the rules the White House is telling you that you have to follow?
I don't know what you mean. You mean new rules?
Rules, regulations, you know, governing philosophies, perhaps, due process and the like. What do you know about what happens next time you want to ask a question to the president? Can you ask?
You said rules. So here's what I know, and I'll be very serious and direct about this, is there was a lawsuit. Well, there was an effort by the White House to ban a certain correspondent. That correspondence network sued to undo that, which was totally appropriate. It's ridiculous to, for the first time in the modern era, revoke a pass to the White House and actually ban a reporter because you don't like the way they're acting in the at a press conference. But anyway, as part of the White House eventually backed down, that certain reporter has been given back his hard pass, which allows him into the White House grounds. But in writing that specific reporter, the White House outlined what they called new rules, informing him of new rules. That was then shared with the White House press corps. But this was kind of like a letter to that certain reporter. I'm not sure these are new rules.
Okay, all right.
Remind me what the rules were as described to
my understanding,
that certain reporter?
My understanding is that when you're called on for a question, you get one question, not multiple questions. And should the question go on and answer it in some way, you relinquish the microphone because you're not permitted to ask a follow-up question of any sort. Have I got that about right?
Hey, Rick, you've seen me at press conferences, right?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Have you ever seen...
That's the follow-up question, John. I'm going to have to rule that out of order. That's not going to be appropriate here.
Have you ever seen me not ask a follow-up question?
No. I cannot recall. I do recall a certain exchange where you asked the president if he talked to Bob Mueller, and that seemed like it was a clear enough answer.
100%. Yes, he
would. I don't think you needed the follow-up that time. Yeah. But maybe short of that, this is going to be an interesting one.
First of all, the White House Correspondents Association put out a statement saying that they had absolutely nothing to do with the crafting of this letter to Jim Acosta that included, you called them, what'd you call them?
Rules.
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 So absolutely no role in that. This was in a court filing. I don't see this as as an official, what'd you call it, man?
I don't remember. It's already gone out of my mind.
As long as there have been White House press conferences, there have been reporters asking follow-up questions. That is not going to change, Rick Klein.
Well, I just hope that you have a hard pass next time we have a podcast.
Well, like I said, Fingers crossed. New rules for this podcast. But look, I mean, that is, you know, any reporter worth his or her salt has to listen to the answer and be prepared to ask a follow-up question based on the answer. That doesn't mean you get into a wrestling match with a White House staffer over a microphone. It doesn't mean you start yelling at the president. It doesn't mean you have a right to ask the president 15 questions. It doesn't mean that you stand up and challenge the president and debate the president. But it means that when there is a press conference, when you are called on, you ask a question, you listen to the answer, and you are fully prepared to ask a follow-up, which is almost always the appropriate thing to do.
All right. Duly noted. John Carl, violating the rules already. We'll see how that goes.
But and I will tell you, Rick, I mean, you and I have had an ongoing conversation. I mean, I believe that reporters are there to ask tough questions, to get the news, to try to break some news from time to time, to report the news. We are not there to make a scene and to, you know, make a show of confronting the president. But that doesn't mean that we shy from asking questions that make the president uncomfortable and absolutely ask follow-ups.
Do your job. I agree.
Okay. Well, that's good. Now that we dispense to that, we'll get to the new rules later. But first of all, Rick, we have so much. I want to get to the Ivanka emails. Don't worry. We're going to get to the Ivanka emails. But I want to talk about what's going on with the last races that are still outstanding and in the big race that is yet to come, the race to Speaker. And we have, just while we were talking about the new rules, we had somebody walk into the Powerhouse Politics studio, our spacious studio here at the ABC Washington Bureau. I think arguably the single best reporter on Capitol Hill. I don't think there's anybody.
Arguably?
I don't think there's anybody. I don't think there's anybody even close. But we have Mary Bruce. Mary Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Hey, gang. Thanks for having me.
And you are the senior congressional correspondent.
Yes.
So
you're going to ask me to do math. I can already tell by the look on your face, John Carl.
Do some math. So where are we? How many seats have the Democrats picked up as of this moment?
All right, math pop quiz. I came prepared. You see my
look at that. She's got notes.
Here.
Mary
Bruce
is in the studio with notes.
I got numbers written down because I'm out of fingers to count on. By our count, right, Democrats now are at 232, which if you're doing math, which I'm going to try to do right now, means that Nancy Pelosi could afford to lose 14 in her race for the gavel. Right now, there are 16 members and potentially one would-be member who have said that no way, no how are they ever going to sign on to support Nancy Pelosi.
Okay, do you mind if I ask a follow-up?
16 is more than 14, yes.
So we have the letter with 16 names, but weren't there several other incoming members who said that they would not support
potentially,
Pelosi, but did not sign the letter?
And I'm glad you bring that up. There are more. So by our count, you have roughly 20 members who've said they will not.
Math
is getting trickier. But the bottom line is whether it's 16 or 20, that number is more than she can afford to lose. So right now, the math is not in Nancy Pelosi's favor. The gavel is at risk. But the big important but here is that no one has still come forward to dare formally challenge Nancy Pelosi. And if you talk to Nancy Pelosi, and we've been asking her the same question, she's so sick of being asked about the speakership, she continues to just ooze confidence. She claims she has the votes. We know that Nancy Pelosi, no one's better than whipping votes than her. She's bringing out the big guns, her big political allies. Everyone's making calls. She's confident she's going to get there. And so you have all these members, you know, raising a lot of concerns. A lot of these people, of course, ran on the platform of Never Nancy. But no one's coming forward to say, I'm going to take you down.
So I know Rick's dying to get in here, but I do have maybe one or two more follow-ups. The president weighed in.
He's offering to lend a hand.
Yes. Yeah. First of all, fully endorsed Nancy Pelosi, which I'm sure is very helpful.
I'm sure.
And he even said that there would be Republicans who would offer the votes. And he mentioned Tom Reed of New York?
New York.
Okay. I'm sure Tom Reed appreciated that. but is there any scenario that Republicans would actually offer the votes to get her up to 218?
So I asked Pelosi this very question. Is she willing to accept the president's kind offer? Could she see a scenario in which she would accept Republican support to get to the gavel? She barely let me get the question out of my mouth before she said, no, never. So I don't think that's exactly the path.
So she would turn down the votes if a Republican voted?
I think that's a strong thanks, but absolutely no thanks. So she envisions a way that she can get there without the help of Republicans. There are lots of different ways you can maneuver this. One thing that strikes me as interesting that Nancy Pelosi hasn't answered yet, and we did ask her this, she kind of skirted it a little bit, but whether she's committed to being Speaker through 2020. Is there a situation in which she would be Speaker now and then perhaps relinquish the position down the road that would allow some of these members who said they would never support Pelosi to support someone else before you get into the next election cycle? So there are, that's politics. There are always ways to kind of finagle this. But right now, it seems Pelosi's, first of all, the only one in the race, and she's very, very confident that it is hers to lose. I mean, you heard her say, any would-be challengers, come on in, the water's warm. She seems to be enjoying this a little bit.
The deal's to be cut here, clearly, Barry. And there's a couple of different scenarios here. You have to remember there's not just one vote for Speaker. There's the whole caucus votes. And all you need is a majority there. No one is doubting whether she gets the majority. She's going to be the Democratic choice. The question then becomes, would these 16 or so House members, plus whoever didn't sign the letter, actually vote for Kevin McCarthy for House Speaker and make the Republican House Speaker?
That's I'm going to guess no.
That's a bluff I feel like Pelosi's okay with calling. It's also possible, not a lot of people know this, I know Mary and John know this, but you don't actually need 218. You need a majority of those present and voting. So a couple could decide not to vote, decide to do something else with their time, maybe attend a protest if you're Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, do anything other than show up on the House floor that day, and you get the math there. And then the intriguing thing, I think you're right. When you talk about deals, you're talking about committee assignments, you're talking about specific promises around legislation sometime in the term. You're also talking about the potential for Nancy Pelosi to say, I'm only going to do this for 2 years. And she told the LA Times about a month ago that she considered herself a transitional figure. Now, Robert Draper in the New York Times Magazine has a great profile, spent a lot of time with Nancy Pelosi.
We like Draper here at the Powerhouse Politics podcast.
One of the best. He got a lot of time with Pelosi. And he asked her about this. And in classic Pelosi style, she's not going to negotiate through the pages of the New York Times Magazine. She says, well, aren't we all sort of transitional figures, right? It's an existential thing,
you're
right?
A transitional co-host, I think.
Wow. His hard pass goes again. Just these threats he has. So Pelosi is going to – she knows how to do this thing. And I don't know anyone, Mary, who thinks that Nancy Pelosi won't be the Speaker of the House. She's got this thing. It's just a question of getting there. And the fact that the Democrats had a bigger night than anticipated, the fact that we're talking about close to 40 seats when they only needed 23, it kind of takes a lot of wind out of the sails of those who say we need someone else.
Yeah, and Nancy Pelosi knows how to get this done. I mean, I don't think I've talked to anyone who thinks that she's not going to be Speaker. It's just a matter of how she gets there. There's a lot of fun drama around all of this. And as you mentioned, a lot of these members, it'll be our first question after the holidays. They certainly could just show up and say, vote present.
Right.
Vote, hey, I'm here. Oh, let's all go get lunch. And that way we can say we didn't support Nancy Pelosi. But, oh, well, she got the gavel anyways. And she, is well aware of their lead. She's well aware of the fact that maybe she can just kind of help the party regain control here. She can kind of lead them down the path for the next year or two and then hand off the gavel to someone else, be that transitional figure. There is, I don't know if this is necessarily the message that Democrats wanted to send right out the gate. If you they're back in control. They've won the House, it seems, by, what you could argue is that wave after all, if they're getting close to 40 seats. And to be starting straight out the gate with this kind of, fighting within the party, it's not what a lot of Democrats want. It's probably not what Nancy Pelosi wanted, but this is also the state of the party.
As we've heard said, the Democrats can tend to be a little bit disorganized.
Just a little bit.
Can we talk, Mary, about the one big runoff that's still out there? And I think this is really going to grow in our mind's eye in the coming days. Mississippi. This isn't a runoff. It's an unusual set of circumstances where actually the first round of voting was held on Election Day. There were two major Republican candidates, both of whom were claiming allegiance to President Trump. The Republicans split the vote. So a Republican, who's the incumbent Senator Cindy Highsmith, is advancing to the runoff against the Democrat, Mike Espy, former Clinton cabinet secretary, former congressman, African-American, running here in Mississippi, next door to Alabama. A lot of things kind of going in Republicans' favor in Mississippi. I don't think you have to explain that. The senator there, though, has kind of made things interesting and made a series of comments that have kind of opened the door for Democrats to say how important this is. President Trump's going to be there right on the eve of the election. Mary, are you picking up any rumblings about Democrats either optimistic about Mississippi or at least saying, look, this is a place that we have to make a big statement?
I think just the fact that you have Democrats even talking about the potential of a possible upset in Mississippi, this is a place where, you know, all conventional wisdom says Democrats shouldn't even have a chance. The fact that you have, you know, Kamala Harris has been down there, Cory Booker has been down there. I mean, this is all, you know, very much related to the candidates here. You have Hyde Smith, who has come out and said a few things that have really raised the stakes on race, on voting rights. She's gotten a lot of negative attention for it. We just saw Walmart earlier today, who had donated to her campaign, now pulling that funding back. So it certainly gives Democrats some optimism. I don't know how much you can read into this in the bigger picture, because so much of this is, I think, tied to the comments that Hyde Smith has made in recent days. But just the fact that you've got, you know, Democrats kind of eyeing it is pretty remarkable.
Look, this is absurd. You're saying you think that the Democrats could win in Mississippi? That is as crazy as saying that they could win a Senate seat in, let's say, Alabama. Remind us, Rick, the margin on election. And of course, I'm sure the Republican Party is very grateful to McDaniel, a Bannon protege, for running in that race and keeping Hyde Smith below 50%. But remind us what the margin was on election day.
I'm glad you asked that question.
Well, I'm impressed if you're really going to have this just off the tip of your tongue, man. This is good.
Cindy Hyde Smith won by only about 5,000 votes over Mike Espy. So it's a 41-40 margin right there.
Okay, but now all those votes for McDaniel, who was the third candidate in the race, who was running to the right of Hyde Smith.
That's right.
Those are probably not Mike Espy votes.
Well, and that's the issue, that included Chris McDaniel getting 16% of the vote. And in the exit polls, we asked the question, who would you vote for in the second round? And it would seem, if you play that out, that Hyde Smith is going to win by 20 points or so. But
we've had all these gaffe after gaffe after gaffe.
And this election's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving weekend. You got to ask people to go and vote. And the attention, the energy really has been so far on the Democratic side. I think that's why you see President Trump making two stops there on the eve of the election. This is not the kind of place that Republicans want to worry about. And look, John, we've had Tom Perez on this show before. He's out there talking about how Democrats can compete everywhere. We can run and win everywhere. We're going to be on the ground everywhere. Start in Mississippi. Go make it happen. That's the charge for Democrats. That's why you're seeing some of the 2020 contenders buy into this. And they recognize that, yeah, the big election didn't go their way in Senate races, went their way in House races. But when you have these opportunities, the margins are going to be that close. And it got to at least show that you can do it. And by the way, for these 2020ers that are looking down the road, African-American support is going to be critical for any 2020 map. That's what every strategist will tell you. They got to show that they can make it happen, again, even in places they're not supposed to.
And if SP pulls out a miracle, you'd have two former Clinton cabinet secretaries as freshman members of the Congress, one in the House, one in the Senate, with Donna Shalala. I mean, it's fascinating. So we have some other races outstanding. Right before we came on, do you call it on the air when you're on a podcast?
Yes.
Right before we came on the air, we were talking about the Mia Love race, where Mia Love looked down on election day. The president kind of kicked her while she was down the day after. And then we saw Mia Love go back up as they continued to count votes. But now, what's happened?
Well, now it seems that the Democrat, Ben McAdams, is back up. But only by, what are we, like 600-700 votes? I mean, every day it seems to go up, down, up, down, up, down.
Where are they getting these votes, by the way? Is it trucking them in from Georgia?
Salt Lake City came around, it seems, for the Democrat a little bit. They were, you know, recounting all of these. But it will be interesting to see whether the president's sort of finger-wagging at Mia Love proves to be true or not. Whether Mia Love will come back and say, I didn't need your love, Mr. President.
I mean, if she wins, it would be pretty good, because the president's already, like, you know.
It would be pretty wild. But right now, it does seem that the Democrat is going to pull their, at least right now, is ahead, which would be interesting, because then that would get Democrats closer to Rick Klein's 40, which more importantly than anything else, I believe...
That was my prediction.
No, you were 50, John Carl. Get out of here. It would give Rick Klein bragging rights in this booth.
It would be the ultimate victory, I think. I think
for
we can.
You or for
me. No, for me. For me. For me.
How many other seats are outstanding? How many can they pick up here?
I think the ceiling for them looks like it's around 39, which I think is basically 40.
So you were wrong.
It's basically 40. So, but think about the symbolism of losing Mia Love, what that would mean. First of all, the only African-American woman... in the Republican delegation in the House, their number of women is actually down overall, despite this big pink wave among Democratic women.
Which is amazing. If you just walking through the halls of Congress in this last week, you can really tell the difference. I mean, those hallways for a long time have felt very white, very old.
A long time, forever.
Yeah. And now to have on the Democratic side such diversity, so many young, new faces that do not look like any faces we've ever seen up there before, and on the Republican side. It feels the same, even a step backwards. If you're losing diversity on that side, is just quite a chasm.
And it's Utah. It's Utah. Think about what the signal that would send about this Democratic.
This is Mitt Romney's
victory.
Utah.
Mitt Romney's rock red Republican Utah. And Mia Love's done a lot to separate her. We know that Trump was not very popular in Utah and was one of his weaker states. But Mia Love has her own brand. And if Mia Love is swept out, you're talking about not just Democratic victories in New York and New Jersey and California, but outside Houston and outside Dallas and outside Oklahoma City and outside Kansas City and, yes, outside Salt Lake City. That is a resounding statement about the president's unpopularity in big swaths of the suburbs.
All right, let's turn, before we run out of time here, to Ivanka Trump's emails, the issues raised there. But first, Trevor Hastings is saying we have to take a very quick break.
Do you spend the night tossing and turning? Are you dealing with a stiff neck and back for months? If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you've got to try a Purple mattress. The Purple mattress will probably feel different than anything you've ever experienced because it uses a new material developed by an actual rocket scientist. The Purple mattress feels very unique because it's both firm and soft, so it keeps everything supported while still feeling really comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. Try your Purple mattress with a 100-night risk-free trial, and if you're not fully satisfied, you can return it for a full refund. Your Purple mattress is backed by a 10-year warranty, free shipping, and returns. You're going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. Just text Powerhouse to 474747. The only way to get this free pillow is to text Powerhouse to 474747. Message and data rates may apply.
And welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. The other story that's gotten quite a bit of attention here is the Ivanka Trump apparently was using some personal email to use official government business.
How could she know that's wrong, though, John?
I mean, she was new to government, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, she's brand new. She's never done this before. Who knew that using your private
arcane rules
was frowned upon,
rarely discussed?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just this seems like it's just a media moment. I don't know what else.
Yeah,
is
this
going
is like
on
gotcha
here,
kind of situation.
So this is interesting, though, John. There was reporting on this upwards of a year ago that it happened. What's changed now is that we've started to see these emails. They don't appear to be sensitive in nature. They don't appear to have been confidential, but The regulations on this are very, very clear, and I do recall a certain issue in the presidential
campaign. Oh, right,
Hillary
Clinton had a thing with this, right?
Butter emails. Yeah, it is remarkable that this could be an issue. It also makes me think, John. I mean, all these things that are flying by, that we're sort of used to them being just kind of the noise of the day in Trump's Washington. Once Democrats have the House, they're going to have hearings on things like this. All of these things.
And they're going to be like, they're going to have discovery. They're going to be subpoenaing stuff like this. And we're going to be reading these emails, theoretically.
I still don't think that the Trump White House is recognizing the gravity of that.
I don't think they've quite.
6 months, 6 weeks away
from
that.
But can we just be clear? Because I do want to be, let's be fair. First of all, this is colossally politically stupid, okay? I mean, my God, after a campaign where emails were such a central issue. To not come in and say, look, I'm not touching my personal email. We're going all official. Right? I mean, you're with me on
that. The tone deaf factor is huge. But Do they get that? I mean, to Rick's point, you're over there quite a bit these days, right? I mean, do they understand that these things that just sort of seem as like, oh, come on, how could they not see this coming? Democrats are literally chomping at the bit. Like, all of a sudden you get the sense like, okay, add that to the list, add this to the list. I mean, the list is massive.
Okay, but 2 points. One, first of all, Democrats can way overplay their hands on this. We've seen Republicans do it. So, you know, be careful what you wish for in terms of the investigation mania. Secondly, on the email issue itself, obviously ridiculously politically tone deaf, no question. But let's be very clear. This is entirely different from what happened with Hillary Clinton, who had her own email server, who did all of her government email work with her private email, who did not preserve any of those emails, send them over under the records requirements of the federal government until after the New York Times started reporting on the story and said, okay, well, let me delete a whole bunch of them and I'll give you a whole bunch. They're supposed to be preserved under the Records Act. What we know about Ivanka Trump is that, at least what we're told by her lawyer, Abby Lowell, you remember Abby Lowell, what we're told is that she stopped using her personal email for government work many months ago, that she turned over her emails to be preserved. So it's different. And then there's the other really big difference that, as far as we know, this was not a matter of emailing classified information, which was a big issue with Hillary Clinton. So it is different, but that doesn't make it any less politically tone deaf and ridiculously dumb.
It's the optics of it that really just, I think, are baffling.
Yep.
And I do think that once Democrats are there, they're going to have to pick their spots. And as part of the changeover here, where we talk about Pelosi taking things over, she's going to be restraining a lot of the wild impulses that they may have on the Hill in the coming months. That's not the Pelosi game. And I think it'll remind a lot of people what Pelosi's value is in this. As someone who did this once before, literally the same situation, she became House Speaker with a Republican president. And there were a lot of things to look at in the Bush presidency, and she
worked with President Bush, by the way.
She sure did.
And I think that's part of her argument, I'm sure, that she's making, is that she has the experience that no one can corral sort of this unruly, eager bunch better than Nancy Pelosi. And also, don't forget that Pelosi has quite an interesting record with this president. She has been able to best him at every twist and turn so far. She's been able to, in some cases, get him to go against his own party, to agree to things and side with Democrats. And you know, she doesn't even have a nickname from the president yet. We'll see how long that lasts. But she will, you know, she is well aware that the Democrats run a risk in going to gangbusters on the investigations. They say they know that. They say they're going to rein themselves in. But, man, they are just so eager up there. And it'll be interesting to see how she can kind of keep them in line.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we are entirely out of time. Rick, we were going to use a lot. We were going to play a lot of the president's interview with Chris Wallace. We didn't do that. You know, there's a lot we didn't get to on this Powerhouse Politics podcast, but there's a lot we did get to.
I agree with that. And there were even a follow-up question or two. I mean, this is history.
And this is a special Thanksgiving edition, so I want to say what I am thankful here. I'm thankful that we had Mary Bruce join us for the Thanksgiving podcast. I'm thankful to work with such first-rate colleagues, even you, Rick. I think you're a sound mind. You're not always right in your political prognostications, but at least you can say prognostication. So I appreciate it. I want to be especially thankful for our team here at Powerhouse Politics. Avery Miller, who works so hard, she landed us this booking today of Mary Bruce. I want to thank our Avery Miller, Angie Yak, and, you know, particularly, I have to say, Trevor Hastings.
Out of retirement. Trevor, thanks for joining
us. He showed up for the podcast. Thank you for listening. Have a great Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you again next week.